If you watch the music video for the song Drive by The Cars, you see a decades-long relationship just beginning between the lead singer of the band and the model who stars in the video. This isn't a video, by the way. It's a podcast. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. Polina Poritskova met Rick Ocasek on that video shoot and then later married him. And people couldn't believe it. She was a supermodel, magazine covers all over the world. He was unusual looking. It was like the head cheerleader dating a guy from the AV club. People just couldn't understand it. When a newspaper in New York featured a picture of the two of them together, the headline read, "Beauty and the Beast." And he said to her, "It's okay, honey. I don't think you're a beast." And of course, outside of the people involved, who someone loves is their own business. And people marry for other reasons, better reasons than physical appearance. But what people didn't know, what Polina did not even recognize for some time, was that Rick Ocasek was awfully similar in many ways to Polina's estranged father. It's one of many insights she's been sharing lately, opening up about herself on Instagram, where she has nearly a million followers, and in a new memoir, No Filter, The Good, the Bad, and the Beautiful. Polina tells stories of a really complicated and painful childhood, persistent anxiety and panic attacks, exploitation in the modeling world, and her marriage to Rick Ocasek. He died in 2019 while the two were separated and heading for divorce, and she later discovered that she had been cut out of his will entirely. I don't know if you assume the life of a supermodel is an easy one, but I'm pretty sure you won't after listening to this interview. Polina Poritskova, welcome to Depression Mode.
Hello, and glad to be at Depression Mode, or in, or on.
In. Yeah, pick your preposition. Yeah. Well, you know, we're going to talk about your childhood, your career, your marriage, but first, you know, let's start with Instagram, I suppose, since that's kind of how this came about. You're very vulnerable, you're very open, you're very, obviously, as the title implies, unfiltered on Instagram. You don't have to be. Why did you choose to be that open and vulnerable in that platform?
Well, that was also an accident. When I started Instagram, I didn't actually really know how to use it. And so I would post a couple of pictures here and there and go, oh, okay, so I have like 1,000 followers. Okay, whatever. I was more of a Twitter person at that point. And then my husband died. And my entire world changed and turned upside down. And then the pandemic came around. And then the man that I was in love with left me. And I was just so freaking sad and lonely and shut off from everything and everyone that for me, posting my vulnerabilities on Instagram was literally tossing out bottles into the ocean with little "help me, I'm drowning" messages.
I want to ask about the drowning, because I think that ties into a lot of those situations that we talked about, and we'll get to that. But I want to start really early then in your life. Something a lot of people don't know about you is that you were a refugee as a young child. Can you tell me about that situation?
Well, it's a rather lengthy situation. Let me see how short I can make it for you.
Okay.
My parents escaped then Czechoslovakia in 1968, when during the Soviet invasion, much like the Ukraine invasion not long ago, you know, Soviet Union decided they needed our little country. And everybody knew it was going to happen. And so my parents, young and courageous and wanting a better life, decided to escape and to do so on a motorcycle. And, you know, they didn't think to take me with them, given that they were on a motorcycle and they were going to be going through Russian tanks. And they, you know, naively thought, once we get to a safe place, we'll just send for her. We'll send for our kid. And I was 3 years old, and I was with my grandmother. And they managed to get across the borders and into a refugee camp, and then find out that the borders were now firmly closed and they couldn't get back in because they were now criminals for having left illegally. And I wasn't going to be able to come back out. You know, eventually they were moved to Sweden from the refugee camps. And in Sweden, again, they tried the Red Cross. They tried different avenues to get me out. It wasn't possible. It wasn't going to happen. And so they rather desperately decided on raising public awareness by staging a hunger strike in Stockholm in front of the Czech embassy to sort of, you know, let people know about their plight. And Swedish people really got behind them. And given that they were both very young and photogenic, and they had this sort of tragic story of, you know, escaping communism and, you know, oh, and, you know, we can't get our daughter. The Swedes sort of, they were very amenable to the story. They found it interesting and they sort of became a reality show almost, you know, that it was in all magazines and newspapers. And my parents got sort of famous in Sweden. And so did I by default. I became the pawn between, you know, in the Cold War between the East and the West, completely unbeknownst to me, because of course I'm, you know, in Czechoslovakia with my grandmother and I have no idea what's going on in Sweden. But there were, you know, there would be journalists that would come down to Czechoslovakia and to take pictures of me for newspapers that they could then, you know, elaborate on how, you know, the poor little Paulina prays to God every night in hopes of reuniting with her parents, which was absolutely untrue, but
served a purpose anyway. Yeah,
exactly. And they made me pose with my teddy bears and in my sweatpants and kneeling by the bed and all of this stuff, which was, I always find like somewhat ironic that at the time, I just remember it was such an imposition for, you know, whatever, 5-year-old me to have to deal with these Swedish men who couldn't speak Czech and wore khaki vests with a lot of pockets and that would, you know, gesture to let me know how I should look and what I should do. And I thought, you know what, the faster I do it, the quicker it's over and done with, and then I can just go out and play. And of course, then that at 15 became my career to do exactly
right.
That.
Yeah, the cameras returned. Mm-hmm. So when were you finally able to be reunited with your parents?
Well, my mother made a kidnapping attempt that was sponsored by a Swedish newspaper. And they rather got a better story than they even hoped for because the kidnapping failed. My mother and these two Swedish pilots that brought her into the country, they had, you know, she had a false passport, she had a wig, she was pretending to be one of their wives. And they got busted for speeding when they were on their way to, you know, to kidnap me on my way from school. And they all got put in jail. But again, since this was a very public story, that seeing that Swedish newspapers got even a better story. And so now it became all about, you know, badass Anna Poroskova, you know, Kate went to get her little daughter and now she's in jail and she's 6 months pregnant and, you know, the awful government won't, you know, let her out. And so that kept going for an additional 3 years. My mother was let out of jail because she was pregnant and because she was so high profile, she got amnesty. And then 3 years in house arrest of just her waiting around to see what was going to happen to her as my brother and I were growing up and having no idea that there was, you know, anything particularly strange or wrong about the situation. And when I was 9, the Czech government finally had enough of us and demanded our passports and said, just get the hell out and please do not come back.
So that's most of your life. That's 2/3 of your life if you're reunited at 9. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you have a clear memory of your parents by that point? Did they still feel like your parents?
No. They because they left when I was 3, by the time my mother returned, I was like 6 or 7. And I remember, I mean, I knew she was my mom, but she didn't feel like my mom. My grandmother was my mom. So I saw her as this very pretty lady with a big stomach that came into our lives and then was very depressed about being in our lives. So I didn't really pay much attention to her, really. I had my grandma. And so when we left, And of course, I was not told that we weren't ever going to come back and that I was leaving forever and that I wasn't going to get to see my grandma again. It was, we got to Sweden and met up with my father. I was excited to meet, I thought this was a vacation. Oh, I'm going to get to meet my dad, whom I didn't know at all. I had very vague memories of my father. And then he left my mom pretty much the same day we arrived because he had fallen in love with somebody else, left my mom a complete wreck. And me and my little brother in this brand new country with a single parent who was losing her mind.
Yeah. So you write in the book, it's mentioned a few times, this lifelong anxiety that you've dealt with. Is that where it started, do you think? Can you draw a line to those events and this feeling of anxiety and kind of rootlessness from back then?
Well, I think that I had the propensity to have anxiety anyway, possibly a little genetic disposition there, because my father is also, it appears, a very anxious man. But I had a very loving, safe childhood until the age of 9. And then, you know, ripped away from everything I knew, all safety, everything I had learned up till then completely changed on me from one day to another. And my first panic attack was probably about 6 months after we got into Sweden. And I was staying at my father's house for the night with him and his new girlfriend, and got my first panic attack, which of course I didn't know what it was. I thought I was going to die. And also I was with this man who was supposedly my father, but I didn't really know. And I didn't dare to wake them up. This was in the middle of the night, and I didn't dare to wake him up so that I wouldn't be even less desirable than I already appeared to be. So I just hauled myself to the bathroom and waited to die. And that sounds, you know, it sounds kind of like, well, clearly she didn't die, so it was fine. But it was pretty scary.
It makes a lot of sense for anybody who's gone through a panic attack. The feeling of being about to die is dead on. You mentioned desirable. Did you feel like you weren't a desirable kid to have around?
Well, yeah, pretty clearly. I mean, I knew I was desirable to my grandmother. I knew she loved me. But, you know, my mother, when she was in the Czech Republic, she was not in the world's best position to be my mother, you know. Also, grandmother had taken over that task pretty solidly. So my mother was sort of like a side aunt or something. And then, you know, there we are in Sweden, and my father was very clear about not wanting us. And my mother was obviously going through a serious depression, and there was a lot of crying and a lot of accusations and what a bastard my father was, and she did not have the emotional space, I think, to pay any attention to her children. So it was me and my little brother, and so I was basically raising my little brother. And yeah, I mean, as far as I was concerned, both my parents had demonstrated quite obviously that they would be better off without me.
Okay, so you have separation from the people raising you twice, feelings of inadequacy, feeling unwanted, panic attacks emerging, teenage years. Obviously, it's time to go to Paris to work as a model. That's after the break. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best, because obviously, there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh.
Jay Keith, do you know what I love more than the trivia, comedy, and celebrity guests on our podcast, Go Fact Yourself?
No, what, Ellen?
Sharing all of those things with an actual audience.
Yes, well, lucky for you, Go Fact Yourself is back to being a live audience show.
Woohoo!
Yeah, we've got a free recording coming up on January 15th in Los Angeles and February 11th in Pasadena.
And if you can't make it there, all of our recordings will still be available as a podcast, twice a month, every month on MaximumFun.org.
Yeah, no excuses. So if you're not listening,
you can go fact yourself.
Back with Paulina Porizkova, who had been through a lot of trauma during her childhood and still a teenager, she begins what would become her career. It's all in her new memoir, No Filter. You became a model. You write about being a teenager, like 15, mm-hmm. 16 years old in Paris. And it's so bleak, the sexual harassment or I guess sexual assault that took place, but you didn't really recognize it as that at the time. Can you explain what was going on in Paris when you were still quite young working as a model?
Well, this is 1980 and there were no, obviously there was no like actual rules or laws in place of any sort. It was kind of like, you know, everybody just did what they wanted to. And the modeling business is built on girls. You know, the models are girls. They're not fully fledged women. So there's a lot of taking advantage of these young girls. And, you know, every job can technically be your last one. I mean, it's a complete freelance situation in which you know, if you're not nice and pleasant and if they don't like you, well, then that's the end of your career. So you come in every day and you try to be as obliging and as nice and as pretty as possible. Obviously, the pretty you don't have a lot of control over, but so you can at least be nice and obliging. And of course, it goes with, you know, the what is now called sexual harassment or sexual assault, we thought was called compliments.
Really?
Well, sure. You know, if the photographer exhibited desire in you, it was because you were pretty. So that was good.
Oh, okay. And so how long did that worldview last for you? Like, did you carry that into the rest of your career? Or was that something that you had an awakening about back then, that this was gross?
No, look, when you take a 15-year-old child, you're still malleable, you're still flexible. And as far as I was concerned, this is what the world was. This is how the world worked. It worked like this for me and everybody around me that I saw. So there was nothing unusual about it. We, you know, you learned how to fend off horny men. That was a part of your job description. You know, make sure that you placate their egos so they book you again. But, you know, sort of do it with like good cheer, you know, like, oh, yeah, you are like, oh, Well, hello there, men in open bathrobe. It's not that I don't want to. It's just that I am really in a rush to get some toast. Yeah, that's right.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so, and that was my life, my entire life from my entire career. So actually, it wasn't until like, I think my mid-40s, me and my girlfriend, who also used to be a model in the 80s, were watching an Oprah episode, of all things. And they had a sexual harassment in the workplace segment. And we looked at each other and we went, sexual harassment? I thought that was compliments. And it was literally not until then that it dawned on us that, like, oops, I guess it was inappropriate.
Wow. Well, so you had this idea of wanting people wanting you around when you were a kid, and whether or not they wanted you around, you know, being left with your grandmother while your parents, you know, were separated from you for so many years. What did this do to this idea of somebody wanting you? Because the being wanted means so many different things. Like, you're a supermodel, and so people are lusting after you, even though you're a child, really. Like, did the modeling career kind of make you feel better about being wanted? How did that work?
I think it masked my loneliness and my the very little self-worth and the very little self-confidence I had with this massive ego. You know?
Yeah.
It's a very strange combination, but the adoration of crowds, I confused with love for a long time. So it wasn't unpleasant. And also, you know, I went from, you know, Sweden, where I was pretty mercilessly bullied as a child, to, you know, and going from being called moose to being, oh, you're one of the most beautiful women in the world. It's like, whoa.
Wait. Why did the Swedes call you moose?
Because I was tall and awkward, like a lot of models are when they were growing up.
Uh-huh.
You know, skinny. And the popular girls in school were short, busty, and blonde. So I was pretty much everything but that.
Okay, well, Swedes are bad at evaluating the potential of models. We can mark that down.
Yeah. Or at least kids are when they are 13 and 14, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You meet Rick Ocasek and fall in love with him when you're 19 years old. You do the video for Drive by the Cars. You've explained it as being just consumed by this love and devotion for this man. Was that because he was so handsome or so nice, or was there something in you that he was fulfilling? Or how did that work?
Well, I mean, I think you just answered your own question, didn't you? Of course.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I did think he was absolutely beautiful. I thought he was sort of beautiful in an alien way. And he did have the most beautiful eyes, these turquoise eyes and a mop of black hair. So I was attracted to him physically. But when we first met, which was right before we did the Drive video, when he entered the room, I literally felt like I've already known him. Like, I've known him my whole life. And when you're 19, you think that's super romantic, right? It's like, oh my God, we're soulmates. We meet and our eyes across a crowded room and we're just drawn to each other like magnets. And it's, you know, it's love. This is what life is all about.
It's like the movies.
Exactly. It's exactly like the movies. It's a teenage wet dream, for God's sake. And it didn't become sort of apparent to me that this sense of familiarity with my husband until I, you know, years later, I was in therapy trying to deal with my anxiety. Came around to going, oh, wait, the reason was he was so familiar is because, in fact, he was representing my father and my grandmother, the two kinds of love that what, you know, childhood, what I understood, the kind of love that I understood. And my father was also a tall, very actually conventionally handsome man with white eyes, very talented, somewhat remote, didn't have many friends. And my grandmother was, you know, completely possessive and obsessive with her love and just sort of, you know, one could say smothering, but of course, as a child, I adored it. And that was my husband in a nutshell. He was all of those things. So no wonder he was familiar.
Right. Right. He gave you everything you needed.
He gave me everything I knew.
Yeah. Was he smothering in his love?
Yes. Yes. He was very, very jealous. And he did want me all to himself at all times. He didn't want me to have any friends. And he was very specific about the things that he wanted in return for his enormous love. And those things, I remember initially, I maybe, you know, would balk at some of them. I was like, why can't I be friends with my gay friends? They're no threat. And they'd go, well, they would turn straight for you. And then I had to give up my gay friends. But again, I did all of this willingly because what I got in return was this love that I recognized. I was with my husband for many, many years. I felt like I was home, like I was safe.
Yeah, and stable. I mean, this is a successful musician and he's all over you. That must have felt like finally you could stand on the ground and feel secure.
Well, it was somebody who made me feel worthy of his love. Also, I think in part because he was very happy to point out my mistakes or my shortcomings. You know, and I remember for years, I thought that actually, I think until we started getting divorced is when it dawned on me. I thought, you know, all this time, I mean, I felt absolutely loved by him and I loved him absolutely in return. But all of those years that we were together, whenever I would start talking about things that interested me, like classical music or literature or history, he would just start yawning and look around and was absolutely not engaged in the conversation. And so I thought that I was boring. And I literally didn't discover that I really kind of wasn't boring until we separated. And I thought, oh, wait a minute. I suspect it's him who's boring.
Yeah. In reading the book, I got to say, I raised my eyebrows a little bit when you talked about meeting Rick and then asking him to leave his wife and children for you, just as he had left a previous family for that wife.
Oh, I didn't ask him to do that.
You didn't?
No, that's not what the book says. The book says that when we met, I had no idea he was married. And he told me he was married a few weeks into our relationship where I was already kind of passionately in love with him and thought this is the man I'm going to spend the rest of my life with. But he also left out that he had children. So he told me he was married and I was with a boyfriend. So I was like, I'll leave my boyfriend. You leave your wife.
You didn't know about the kids.
No, I had no idea about the children. The two of the children came in, 7, 8 months later into our relationship when I kept saying, look, I left my boyfriend. So what's up? That's when it came to light where he said, well, there are children involved.
Did that change your view of the relationship?
It definitely did throw cold water on it because I was a child of divorced parents. So this was not just, you know, leaving the person that you're not suited to be with anymore. This we're talking about a whole level of, this would be me becoming my father's mistress. And so I tried to break up with him and then, you know, I couldn't because I was so madly in love and he was so madly in love with me and we were meant to be together. And it was only that he hadn't met me in time, probably because I was not yet born when he should have met me. So, yeah, that overtook any sensible notions of behavior, really.
Was the anxiety still an issue? Were the panic attacks still an issue this whole time and into your marriage?
Oh my God, yes. I mean, and see, here again comes my husband. Until I met my husband, I had diagnosed myself with a heart condition. I thought I had, because my mother was in medical school. And so when I kept getting these panic attacks, I looked it up and I thought, oh, I have a heart condition. I'm, you know, maybe heart arrhythmia or something like that. And it's eventually going to kill me. So I fully expected to die young. I didn't tell anybody about it because I didn't want anyone to, it was shameful to me that I was so defective. And when I met my husband, I told him I think it was actually the first time we met. And I said, you know, I'm so nervous right now, I'm likely to pass out. And he said, if you do, I'll catch you.
That's some powerful words right there.
And then when he noticed that I would have these spells, he said, you know, do you know what this is? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to die. He said, no, this is called anxiety attacks, and I have them too. And so, again, it was incredibly bonding because then I did go to a doctor, had it diagnosed. Yes, I wasn't going to die. I was perfectly fine. But, you know, we understood each other so well. You know, he had anxiety attacks. I had anxiety attacks. He would tell me about his. And when they happened, I knew what he needed from me and he knew what I needed from him. It was a bonding experience, our anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah. So then it draws you even closer. Mm. And you were married for many, many years. How was the decision eventually reached to separate and divorce? How did that come about?
Well, you know, like all marriages, it's not something you don't wake up one day and go, oh, I've had enough of you, I'm out. We were married all together for 30 years. We were together as a couple for 33. So my entire life, really. And the last 2 years of our 35 years together, we were separated, but still living together. Still, I thought, best friends. You know, the marriage just started sort of tanking when I was getting into my middle age, my late 40s, and I had been growing up. You know, Rick got me as a 19-year-old and he was a fully grown adult.
He was 40 when you got together, correct?
He was 41, although he told me 41. He was 36, so he did lie a bit about that too.
Okay.
So I grew up and he stayed the same. And at some point that became a problem because I no longer wanted exactly what we always had. I no longer wanted the isolation of just being, you know, the two of us and then the three of us and the four of us. You know, I wanted a little bit more of the world, and I wasn't content with, I no longer saw his word as the word of God. You know, I started having my own opinions, and I went into therapy for my anxiety, and I started solving a lot of my own emotional issues. And he was not on that same train. He was absolutely uninterested in therapy. When I asked him to go to therapy together to fix our, to help us fix our marriage, he said, nah, that's okay. I don't believe in therapy. You do your thing. And then let me know when you're happy again. So
yeah,
that sort of a marriage is not going to last.
Coming up, the marriage ends, Rick Ocasek passes away, and then a whole new kind of trouble begins.
Hey there, it's Annabelle Gurwitch.
And I'm Lara House. We host Tiny Victories, the 15-minute podcast that's about the little things.
Getting into the tiny victory frame of mind is about recognizing minor accomplishments and fleeting joys.
Isn't it a wonderful day when the first password you try actually works?
When it's freezing cold outside and toasty as all get out in my shower, my tiny victory is that I turn off the water and get on with my day.
We can't change this big, dumb world, but we can celebrate the tiny wins.
So join us on Maximum Fun or wherever you listen to podcasts. Let's get tiny!
Back with Paulina Porizkova, model, actor, and author of the memoir No Filter. Before the break, Paulina was detailing the end of her marriage to a man she had been with for well over 30 years, since she was 19 years old. Was there a feeling of trauma in your life from the ending of that marriage before he died, or did it feel like, okay, this is a healthy conclusion, everything ends, this is the logical end, and it's fine?
Well, it wasn't necessarily trauma, but there was a great deal of sorrow and sadness and insecurity because, of course, I thought we were going to be together for life. And so when he wouldn't help me work on our relationship, when he didn't seem to care how I felt, when he wouldn't touch me anymore, when he stopped complimenting me and telling me that he thought I was beautiful, you know, it was coincided with me, you know, turning 50 and feeling invisible to the rest of the world, having no career. And now my husband's not even faintly interested in me besides, you know, making his morning coffee and providing him with his blueberry yogurt. So it was just an incredibly lonely time. I felt like I was just wandering the desert, you know, just looking like going, where am I? Who am I? Where am I supposed to go next? And I don't know. I can't see where to go. And there's nobody here to walk with me. So it was a very sad, very lonely time. But I wouldn't call it trauma because I've experienced trauma.
Yeah.
Trauma is a little different.
Okay. Well, at the time that he died, you were separated but living together. Can you tell us what happened on the day your husband died?
He had surgery, which went very well. He was recuperating. This is like 2.5 weeks later. He's at
a cancer surgery, correct?
Yep, stage zero. So he was doing great. He was back home and, you know, up and around. And that Sunday morning, he had been getting up earlier since he came back from the hospital because of the hospital times, you know, they made him get up early. Usually he would sleep until 11 or 12, you know, he was a rock star. So he went to sleep really late and got up really late. So, you know, at 9:10 was the time where he had been getting up and he wasn't up yet. And again, I was like, I feel like he should be up, but then, you know, maybe he's finally kind of gotten back to his rhythm again. And by 11, I thought, well, maybe he had a hard night, but, you know, I'm just going to go and bring him a coffee and make sure that he's okay. And so I poured a cup of coffee and brought it up to him. And I walked into the bedroom and he looked like he was sleeping. So he was in exact same position that I knew him to sleep in always. And so I just walked up and I set the coffee right down next to him. And that's where I sort of, you know, looked down at his face. And that's when I realized it's, you know, that his eyes did not look like eyes anymore.
How long after that was the reading of the will?
Oh, like, you know what? After that, I don't have a very clear sense of time.
Yeah.
But the funeral was a week later, and I know the will came before the funeral. So I think it was maybe 2-3 days later, something like that.
And what was said in the will?
Oh, the will had a nice little sort of note at the front of it that said, I will not provide for my wife because she abandoned me.
I hate to reduce this to this basic of a question, but how did that feel?
Well, there's not a super basic answer to this very basic question. My brain was already full with what I just saw and my children screaming and me crawling down 3 flights of stairs on my elbows because I couldn't use my legs after I realized what had happened. And I could barely function. So seeing this, I just thought, well, that's a mistake. Like I couldn't comprehend it. It didn't make any sense to me. It was such a flat out lie that it just made no sense. It was like somebody made this shit up and they just put it in there. And I don't know why.
Yeah. You've talked about how in meeting him, there was this representation of this stability. You know, he loved you. He smothered you with love. He protected you. He walled you off basically, but in this place of security. So now he's gone and you lose the security. What did you think about the future in that moment? Like, what did you think was going to happen to you?
I honestly had no idea. Have you been through grief?
Yeah.
So, you know what those first acute moments are like, right? I don't even really remember what I did half the time. I have the hardest time to recall even the first year, except for being kind of pushed and shoved into lawyers' offices because my girlfriends, thank God for my friends, you know, they're the ones that showed up right after his death and they gathered around and we sort of sat a Christian shiva and they took care of everything. They helped me set up the funeral and me and my boys, we were just in such tremendous shock that we really couldn't function one way or the other. And you know, and as time wore on, I started realizing what position, but little by little, it was like drop by poison drop, I started understanding the repercussions that those words had. So it wasn't it wasn't a full-on moment where I was like, how dare he? It was little by little by little, and I kept making excuses for him for the longest time. Oh, it was his divorce lawyer that made him do it. And, you know, he didn't mean it, or he must have been pissed off. And maybe he wrote this like, you know, a few months ago when we had an argument. Like, I was trying to make sense of why this man, the man that had been my partner for my entire life, really, why he would do this. It just seemed incomprehensible. And then when, you know, a year in, when I realized, was like, oh, okay, so yeah, I have assets, I have houses and pension plans because we were still married, but I have no cash. I have no way to pay for anything. I have no way to pay taxes on the houses or pay the mortgages on the houses. Like, I'm kind of screwed. So I immediately have to sell one of the houses. And, you know, COVID. Oh, good luck trying to sell your house right in the middle of COVID in New York City. Guess what?
Nobody's leaving their houses.
Well, nobody wants to buy a house in like Plague Town.
Yeah.
So yeah. That was like, timing was not great. But it, you know, it started sort of, again, it was kind of filtering a little bit at the time. And you know, and of course, you know, and then you have like the gossip websites and everything sort of trumpeting, what did she do? What did the bitch do for the poor man to, you know, how awful was she? What is the truth of the horrible dark marriage of, you know, Paulina and Rico Classic? Like, how horrible must she have been in order for him to do something like this to him? That was that was just, you know, that was just like an added on like thing for me to have to deal with on top of everything else.
When I look at your life and when I look at this double shot of circumstances of his death and then this will, like if this was fiction, if this was a novel, I would expect that character to crumble and never be heard from again and never do anything. And here you are, and here's this book, and here is this social media presence that is so remarkable for so many people.
Thank you.
Did it surprise you that you had this well of strength to draw from?
It surprised me. No, it didn't surprise me. Now, you know, 3 years later, at 57, I look back and I think, I've had that strength my whole life. The circumstances just showed me exactly how much of it I had. But, you know, I did. It's not that I didn't consider checking out for a bit, you know. That very much at the same point where I started posting my vulnerable posts.
How do you manage what you've been through today, besides writing a book?
Yeah, the book is kind of, it's funny. It's not really a part of the survival. It's just, it's more of a looking ahead. You know, I mean, I've been writing. That's what I've been doing. So to me, it's like, this is the next stage of my life is me as a writer, not as a model, clearly. It's not super high demand for women my age. Going through that kind of stuff, I think when you do find yourself at least sort of, you know, sighting the end of the light of the tunnel comes, I mean, I've had to do so much work. I had to do so much work on myself, on acceptance, on forgiveness. And for that matter, realizing my own part in this, like, where did I go wrong? Where, you know, what are my mistakes? How did I contribute to this setup? Because it's never just one person. It's not like my husband is the beast and I am the one who did everything perfectly. It was like two people and who obviously saw things a little differently. But what was my part in this? So I've spent the last 3 years in serious therapy, and I've like literally done every bit of woo-woo shit you can think of that I have thumbed my nose at in the past. And I had no other solutions. Like if I wanted to stay alive, I had to do something. So fine, I'll do past life regressions and I'll go to psychics and I'll do tapping and I'll do EMDR and I'll do hypnosis and I'll do virtually everything you can possibly think of, meditation, exercise, this. The only thing I didn't do was go back on antidepressants. Because I felt like this was something that had to be chewed through, not set aside. Mm. And because I had been on antidepressants before in my life, I knew, I understood the calming effect of it and how it made your life easier place to navigate. I mean, there were times where I considered going back on because I was afraid that otherwise I'm going to do something really stupid. But I never got shoved all the way to the brink. So I resisted.
What worked the best of all these things that you mentioned trying?
You know that when you do a major combination of everything, you can't tell what works best. What I can tell you is that when you put it all together, it works.
Okay. The book is No Filter, The Good, the Bad, and the Beautiful. The author is Paulina Porizkova. Paulina, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was depression, all right?
We go places on this show.
Great. I'm going to go and drink a bottle of whiskey.
That's Paulina Porizkova. A reminder about our program, we don't endorse the use of antidepressants. We don't condemn the use of antidepressants. We bring you people with a range of opinions on a range of treatments. We suggest exploring for yourself what works best for you. Next time on Depression Mode, comics creator Kate Beaton worked in a Canadian oil camp. Mental health crises were all around, and the oil company addressed that by providing a crisis phone number. That was garbage.
There was like a phone number you could call, and it was like someone who's like, hello, like, how are you feeling? And they're like, I think I'm going to like kill myself. And I think that like my life is in turmoil and like my marriage is ending. And like, I live in this work camp, and they're like, oh no. And like, they were like underpaid therapists who were completely unequipped for the type of crisis that people would be in, and they specific to these work environments that are very built to create mental distress.
Kate Beaton, author of the book Ducks, joins us. Hey, if people support our show, we can keep having a show. We like having a show. We think that you like listening to it, so we need your support. It's easy to do. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join, pick a level that works for you, and then select our show from the shows available. If you are already a donor to the show, thank you. You are helping people. You are bringing this to the world. You are making a difference. If you haven't yet joined, wouldn't you like to make a difference? Wouldn't you like to help people? I think you would. Our merchandise shop is open. We have a variety of Depression Mode goods and goodies. We have everything from beanie caps to sweatpants to blankets to note cards. A lot of it emblazoned with, I'm glad you're here, which is something I say on the show every week and that people seem to really respond to positively. All that stuff is available at MaxFunStore.com. That's MaxFunStore.com. Select Depression Mode. You'll see all of our good stuff. Be sure to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write rave reviews. All of that helps get the word of the show out to the rest of the world so it can help more people. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available in the United States by calling 988. The Crisis Text Line, also free and always available. Text the word HOME to 741741. Please use our electric mail address, depressionmode@maximumfun.org, to get in touch with us. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We talk about the show there, but we talk about a lot of other things. People provide help and support and advice to one another. It's a real community, and we'd love to have you be a part of it. We're on Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at John Moe. Hi, credits listeners. When you're getting ready for an interview with Paulina Porizkova and you Google the phrase drive the cars, you get a lot of automobile advertisements, which I should have expected. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows. Maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
I'm Maddox from Washington, D.C., and it's not always going to feel like this.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.